13th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
My first time ever on the radio was on KBOO about 10 years ago on the Soundbox with Dina B. And I've been doing radio ever since. I love KBOO.
KBOO is such a friendly, laid-back, fun environment. There's a lot of freedom here.
Boy, all I can say is that they just give me the complete freedom to play every single thing I feel like playing. And that's a rare thing in radio stations nowadays, and I sure appreciate it.
It's a passion of mine to investigate and to find and to share.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking with Sasha Abramski about his latest book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me on.
How did the book come about?
Well, I've been doing an awful lot of reporting all the way back to the early years of the century, and I've been going all over the country, driving, flying, going to these out-of-the-way communities and talking to people about their everyday lives and about the ways in which they were making ends meet or not making ends meet. And one of the things that I became absolutely fascinated by was that in the middle of boom times, when the stock market was going up, when housing prices were going up, when unemployment was fairly low, in the middle of those boom times, a huge number of men, women, and kids that I spoke with were finding that they couldn't feed themselves. And that was actually my first way in, was going to these food lines and seeing families waiting in line for free food. And then when I talked to them, it wasn't just that they couldn't feed themselves, it was that everything was becoming precarious. So they were finding it harder and harder to pay mortgages or rents. They were finding it harder and harder to either pay medical insurance or to buy medicines if they had no insurance. And at every level, their daily lives were becoming more of a challenge, more of a sort of essentially a sense of daily instability. And then after 2008, all of those things that had already been going on during the boom years, of course, they magnified. And so you started seeing a level of poverty spread all across this country that we hadn't seen in years and years and years. And it wasn't that it was concentrated in one area or another area. You could find it anywhere. So you could find it in inner cities, but you could also find it in suburban tract housing. You could find it in very rural areas, and then you could find it in Los Angeles or New York, or you could find it in Stockton in the Central Valley in California. And I got really, really interested because it seemed to me that what we were witnessing was the emergence in many ways of a new shape of society, that the America that was emerging is something that looked rather unfamiliar. And as a journalist, you always want to be trying to explain the unfamiliar to an audience. That's when I get my most satisfaction as a writer, is if I can take a big story and I can render it familiar and I can bring alive characters and I can bring alive experiences. And it just was an incredible, incredible vein of narrative to mine. And I found it just an extraordinary journey.
Your book has been called a successor to Michael Harrington's The Other America. And does that parse with you, or is that a mistake?
No, it does. I mean, I'm very honored by the comparison because Michael Harrington has always been one of my journalistic and writerly heroes, because I think he did something extraordinary half a century ago. And what he did was he took a narrative and he said, look, the story you're getting is incomplete. And the narrative that he took in the early 60s was that America had entered the age of affluence. And that in the age of affluence, the post-war boom years, everybody was participating in this extraordinary economic growth, and the country was becoming almost 100% middle class. And Harrington had worked for years with people who were homeless, with people who lived in slums, with people who didn't have enough money to buy food for their kids. And he knew that the story of the late 50s, early 60s was an incomplete story, and that millions of Americans were being rendered invisible. Their voices were going unheard.
His immersion in poverty was at the Catholic Worker House in the Bowery. Is that correct?
It is correct. Harrington was Jesuit trained, and he'd spent years working with Catholic Worker and other social justice groups. And a lot of his work was in the Bowery, in the flop houses of the Old Bowery. Obviously, if any of your listeners have been to New York in recent years, the Bowery's changed dramatically. Now it's full of upscale restaurants and boutique bars and so on. But if you went to the Bowery in Harrington's time, you'd encounter an extraordinary level of poverty and desperation and very marginalized, invisible people. And Harrington basically sat down and presented a challenge first to himself and then to the community. And the challenge to himself was, how do I make visible the invisible? How do I bring these people's stories to life? And then the broader challenge was, let's hold up a mirror to America, because here's a country which is espousing a set of ideals, and they're great ideals. They're ideals about equal opportunity. They're ideals about aspirations and about freedom and happiness and so on. They're wonderful ideals, but they aren't always lived up to. And Harrington basically holds a mirror up to early 1960s America, and he says, look, this is a part of our image that we don't like looking at, but it's an important part of our image. What are we going to do about it? And it triggered a huge national conversation. And it resulted in the war on poverty. So when Lyndon Johnson gets up and in his State of the Union address in 1964, he turns the war on poverty into a moral challenge, not just a moral challenge, but a defining moral challenge. And he really did, for many, many years, shift the way America responded to poverty and to inequality. And one of the things I write about is, from the 1980s onwards, we lost that moral energy, and there are many reasons for it. But as a society, we began sort of moving away from a commitment to limit inequality and to limit poverty. The two are very much part of the same story. And what you see over the last 30, 35 years is, at the top of the economy, things have never been so good. We have more billionaires than we ever had. We have more people with extraordinary luxury lives on a daily basis. But on the other hand, at the bottom of the economy, things are increasingly unstable, increasingly precarious. And so a lot of commentators have said that my book is something of a successor to Harrington's book, and I take it as an extraordinary, extraordinary compliment. And I very much hope that your audience, your listeners, if they read my book, I really hope they think about the history and about the similarities and the differences between poverty in the year 2013 or 2014 and poverty in the early 60s when Harrington was writing.
You underline in your book the lack of empathy today compared to 1962, especially with the civil rights movement sort of cueing people to the fact that there was a great deal of injustice. Could you talk about that, the difference between now and then?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I always tell my students when I'm teaching writing and when I'm teaching journalism in particular is I say, be very careful not to put sort of rose-hued glasses on. You don't want to romanticize the past. And I always try not to romanticize the past because I think it's too easy to say, oh, everything's gone to hell in a handbasket today, and things used to be so much better, because the past was by no means rosy, and Harrington would have been the first to acknowledge that. There were tremendous problems in the structure of the society of the late 50s, early 60s. There was endemic levels of racism. There was an extraordinary sort of sexual hierarchy where women, especially middle-class women, were supposed to stay at home. There were all kinds of unpleasant hierarchies, and poverty was very prevalent in the early 60s. So it's not that all was good in Harrington's time, but I do think that there was a moment, there was a period in the 60s when, as a culture, we were willing to confront a lot of the problems in the society and look for very creative solutions. And that partly came from the bottom up. It partly came from tremendous grassroots organizing efforts. Everything from Cesar Chavez in California organizing the farm workers, all the way through to Stonewall in the late 1960s defining gay rights. So there was this moment when the language of empathy was allowed to flower from the grassroots up. But I think the other thing was, we had a political leadership that really thought the sky's the limit, that believed that anything America set its mind to do, it could accomplish. And that went all the way from the moonwalk, the fact that in the early 60s, Kennedy had said, we're going to get a man on the moon and we're going to do it within a decade, all the way through to the war on poverty, where Johnson could use the moral platform of the presidency of the United States and say, we are going to end poverty in America. He didn't just say we're going to limit it. He said we're going to end it. Now, with hindsight, I actually think that was a mistake, because I think it set the stage for backlash. It's very hard to end poverty. In fact, you could say it's impossible. All societies are going to have a level of poverty. The question is how much. And actually, the war on poverty did a tremendous amount of good. It took millions and millions of Americans who were poor at the start of the 1960s, and by the mid-70s, they'd been raised out of poverty. By many measures, what happened in the 60s and the early 70s was a tremendous success. But because it was overambitious in the language, it set the stage for backlash. And I think one of the things you saw was by the 80s, a politician like Reagan could very effectively use public anxiety about the amount of money that had been spent on the war on poverty and use it to craft a very reactionary political rhetoric. So one of the ways, not the only way by any stretch, but one of the ways Reagan built a coalition in 1980 was through bashing people on welfare. He talked about welfare queens.
Didn't Nixon did the same thing 4 years after?
The interesting thing about Nixon was Nixon talked the talk when it came to wedge issues. He was as good as anyone at manipulating public opinion in a pretty destructive way. But when it actually came to policy, Nixon was fairly good on poverty. Nixon proposed universal health care. At one point, Nixon embraced Milton Friedman's idea for a basic income guarantee. No president before or since has embraced that idea. It didn't go anywhere. But in many ways, Nixon was a continuum of Johnson. He expanded food stamps. He expanded the free breakfast and lunch program for low-income kids at school. But in the late 70s, and especially once Reagan comes to power in the 80s, there really is a dismantling of much of the safety net infrastructure. And you see it both with Republican and with Democratic presidents. You see it most noticeably, in fact, in 1996, when President Clinton signs a welfare reform that years and years later, we see one of the effects is that only 25% of poor families in America now qualify for welfare.
Right. Well, welfare to work requires that they're jobs.
That's right. And, you know, so one of the things we saw in the worst recession since the Great Depression, from 2008 and the years following, in many, many states, the number of people on welfare actually declined. Now, that didn't mean that single women with kids were suddenly getting affluent. What it meant was that the state was rolling back its responsibilities. And I talked to people. I talked to people all over the country who weren't eligible for benefits. And their lives were extraordinary. I talked to people with literally no access to cash, people surviving either on food stamps, which is a non-cash benefit, or on charity. People scavenging anything they could. I talked to families who literally had nothing, and I'd say to them, well, you know, when you say you have nothing, do you mean you have $100, $200? They said, no, nothing. They didn't have bank accounts. They didn't have savings. They didn't have money in their wallet. They didn't have food in their fridge. They lived lives entirely on or outside the margins. And I think that happens gradually. You don't suddenly go from a war on poverty to the kind of extraordinary lack of empathy we see, not across the spectrum, but in some parts of the political process these days. It didn't happen overnight. It took years and years in which the political rhetoric shifted, in which our understanding of poverty, in a sense, was dumbed down. We came increasingly to think of it almost as an individual disease. If you were poor because you'd done something wrong, or you were somehow morally unworthy. In a way, it's a very 19th century understanding of poverty, the idea of an undeserving underclass, a group of people who are poor because it's their own fault. And one of the consequences is that as a society, increasingly we washed our hands. We just said, look, this is a tragedy maybe, but it's not something we can do anything about. And one of the things I wanted to explore in my book was, is it a tragedy or is it something else? And I concluded that calling it a tragedy, in a sense, is too easy. That what it is it's a scandal. And the reason it's a scandal is this is the most affluent country in the world. This is the country with more resources than any other country in human history. And yet, one in four of our kids lives below the poverty line. 50 million Americans, all told, live below the poverty line. Many, many millions of Americans live below half the poverty line. We have a level of poverty and a level of inequality that no other first world democracy comes anywhere near matching. And to my mind, that becomes a scandal. And the difference between a tragedy and a scandal is a tragedy is sort of an act of nature, or it's an act of individual catastrophe. What it isn't is a societal problem, whereas a scandal is a societal problem. And it seems to me that we've made a series of political choices and economic choices that have, in a sense, built up this well of poverty at the bottom of the economy. And it isn't just the unemployed. It's also the working poor. I spoke to a woman in Dallas, Texas, just outside Dallas, called Mary Vasquez, and she was 67 years old. And she'd had heart attacks, she had cancer, she'd had diabetes, she had high blood pressure. And she came into the interview on a walker, and she looked about 80. And she worked for Walmart, and she worked full-time for Walmart, and she still earned less than $2,000 a month. And that was before taxes. And she told me about how she oftentimes missed meals, and when she didn't miss meals, all she could afford was TV dinners. And that's the face of working poverty. I met a woman in Albuquerque, a young woman whose family had been bankrupted by medical bills. Now, again, her husband had had a job, but it didn't come with health insurance. And they had earned so little money that for a while they were on public assistance, and then he got a pay raise. $1 an hour, but it was enough to bounce them off of Medicaid. And then she ends up with a ruptured appendix, and the family ends up with nearly $100,000 in medical bills. Now, again, to my mind, that's a scandal, because these are working families. They're playing by the rules. They're doing what they can to get ahead, and they're being swept backwards. And I, over the course of the years that I was reporting my book, I met so many people who had these stories that to me were just extraordinary. People who were told they were ineligible for Medicaid because they'd bought themselves a burial plot for when they finally died. I spoke to people in Stockton who'd bought houses, and then the houses were not just a little bit underwater, but massively underwater. And then they lost their jobs during the recession because there was no construction going on in Stockton. And again, these guys were doing everything they could to get ahead, and instead they were being swept backwards. And they were selling their household possessions in garage sales so that they could get just enough money to pay their next bill.
The thing that scares me is that with the Tea Party mentality, you have this belief that poverty is worthwhile, that it's a means of social control, and that the poor are not deserving, they're undeserving. And if anything, they deserve to be marginalized and dismissed.
One of the things that I did a lot of reading around the history of poverty in America, obviously, and a lot of thinking about poverty. And one of the things that struck me was that, in a sense, we've always been far more than one coherent country. We've been, at the very least, two distinct political cultures. And that goes all the way back to the pre-Civil War years. And I think what you see is that the North and the industrial Midwest, and to a degree the West, built in aspiration and built in opportunity and built in upward mobility as a sort of defining part of their economies. And the South did the opposite. The South basically institutionalized immobility. And if you were poor in the South, you were going to stay poor. Everything about the Southern economic structure was designed to create a group at the bottom that was immobile. And that group, obviously, before the 1860s would have been slaves, after the 1860s, tenant farmers, and so on. But there was a structure of immobility built into the Southern model. And one of the things I write about in my book is, it seems to me in recent years, in many ways, the Southern model has come to percolate more generally into the national, both the national economic model, but also the national political culture. And so the language around welfare, today the language around food stamps, where conservatives are going after nutritional assistance as being a safety net program that breeds laziness, that rhetoric, to my mind, historically comes out of the South. And I think it's an extremely dangerous development that we're now putting things like food stamps in the crosshairs, because that used to be immune. Years and years ago, when the conversation was about welfare, in the 1980s, let's say, when conservatives went after welfare, they usually kept silent about food stamps. In the 1990s, there really wasn't much debate about food stamps. But now you see a significant part of the political process trying to find ways to not just marginally cut food stamps, but to massively cut them.
Well,
and
when you...
I think one of the things that gets forgotten in the conversation is we're not talking about abstract numbers. We're talking about real people. And, you know, we're talking about people like Maribel Diaz, who's a woman I met, young woman I met in L.A. And she had worked for the state until the recession hit. And then she was laid off. And she had three kids. And the only thing that was keeping her and her kids fed was food stamps. I met another woman, an older woman, whose husband had run a business, and he died of cancer. And even though they had health insurance, the medical bills had bankrupted them. And she was now a widow, and she was now on food stamps. And she had nothing. And so I think when we talk about cutting food stamps, and especially cutting them for adults, which is what the conversation is about at the moment, there are real people who get hurt when that happens. And I think it's an extraordinary, in a sense, indictment, that we're even at that point where we can have so many people living so precariously, and yet the conversation is about how to cut their benefits.
Did you get a sense that the inside the Beltway mentality sort of makes people indifferent to, you know, the needs of people like the people who are long-term unemployed, the compensation that was denied recently, that these people...
Well, I think that any kind of Beltway mentality ultimately insulates people from the realities on the ground. And I think you can sort of put Beltway in the widest possible. There's obviously the DC Beltway. But I think more generally, there's a Beltway of affluence, might be a way of looking at it.
The gated community. The gated community.
Yeah, it's a gated community, or just a world of living in your own bubble. If you live amidst affluence, it's very easy to pretend and maybe genuinely not to see poverty or not to see insecurity. If you live in a very nice community, a suburban community, well, you probably never see the trailer parks that exist 20 miles outside your city. There's all kinds of ways in which it's easy to not see.
In your book, The American Way of Poverty, you know, one thing that really came across to me was the loss of empathy. And, for example, as I understand it, Walter Heller, who was the head of economic advisors for Kennedy, was the person who actually gave him a copy of Harrington's book. And in combination with Dwight McDonald's article in The New Yorker around shortly after The Other America came out, that... you know, apparently Kennedy read that article on poverty where McDonald underlined the importance of Harrington's book. And he was really moved by that. And that was, as I understand it, that was a spark. And then after the assassination of Kennedy, LBJ continued with it and developed in 64 the War on Poverty. It's difficult to imagine Larry Summers or Tim Geithner giving a book like yours or The Other America to Obama.
Well,
I think
the interesting thing about Obama is he spent many, many years as a community organizer and many, many years working in very poor neighborhoods with very poor people in Southside Chicago. And that's not a veneer. That's not something that was sort of tacked onto his autobiography. It's a real part of his character and part of his history.
Right.
And I do think that instinctually Obama understands issues of poverty, both around individuals and around community, very profoundly, probably more than most presidents since Johnson have done. Though I think actually Bill Clinton also had a very good empathic understanding of what a life of poverty meant, because he certainly grew up in pretty hardscrabble environments. But I think the broader issue is that even if individuals, whether it's the president or members of the cabinet or individual senators, even if individuals at the moment comprehend the magnitude of this problem, the political consensus just isn't there to do anything about it at a federal level. Now, there's plenty of really interesting creative stuff being done at state level. There's plenty of really interesting things being done at city level.
Well, you mentioned the National Domestic Workers Alliance. That was
the Domestic Workers Alliance is fascinating because it's taking a group of incredibly marginalized, very, very exploited and vulnerable workers, and it's trying to organize them, and it's doing a fairly good job about organizing them, getting them to think as a community, getting them to push for wage increases and benefits protections. The other thing that I found absolutely fascinating in the last few months is this series of labor actions that's occurring at Walmarts around the country and in fast food outlets around the country. And I've been interviewing a lot of the fast food workers, and these are workers who earn $7-$8 an hour. And they're almost always part-time, and they come with, you know, they get almost no benefits that go with their work. And they live these incredibly vulnerable lives. I just interviewed a woman who was living in a one-bedroom studio, and it was, if at most, 150 square feet. It was just literally a bed facing a stove and a sink and a small fridge. There was no bathroom. The bathroom was in the hallway, and it was shared with three other occupants of the house. And these people traditionally have been the most exploited and in many ways the least able to organize to change their own conditions. And yet over the last few months, McDonald's, KFC, Pizza Hut, all of these fast food outlets have been seeing walk-offs. And they've been seeing people protesting for a living wage. And it actually gives me tremendous hope because I think even though the political culture is beset by this lack of empathy, if you actually get people one-on-one and you start talking with them, most people will sympathize with the idea that if someone's flipping hamburgers or baking pizzas all day long and standing on their feet all day long, they should, at the very end of the day, at the very least, be able to buy their own food in the evening and have a decent place to live and put gas in their car or buy a bus pass if they ride public transport. And I think that, for me, this actually gives me tremendous hope, is that even though there's this stalemate federally, on the ground, there's some really interesting stuff going on. And I think that in some ways, that's a precursor to any activity that's going to happen in D.C. It's not going to come from the top down. And I think that it very rarely in American history has come from the top down. Usually, interesting social reforms are triggered by grassroots activism, and then they sort of push upwards. And Roosevelt knew this very well. When Roosevelt was trying to get the Fair Labor Act and all the other great reforms of the 30s passed, he told union leaders to push him. He's on record as saying, make me do it. And I think that's a really sort of interesting lesson, is that almost always, even if a president has really interesting instincts and really good instincts, it takes a degree of nudging from below to realize those instincts. And I think we're going to start seeing some of that in the next few years.
Well, we recently celebrated the Poor People's March of 63, and that was a good case of people just from the ground up pushing Kennedy and the administration to acknowledge the needs of black folks.
Well, I you saw it with the Poor People's Marches in the 60s. You saw it, obviously, with the Civil Rights Marches. And, you know, the fact that hundreds of thousands of people were coming into Washington to push for social justice. And it made a tremendous impact. All the contemporary records suggest it made a tremendous impact, first on Kennedy, on John Kennedy, and then on Lyndon Johnson, and then later in the decade on Bobby Kennedy. And I think that it's a huge part of the American story, is that notion of pushing for social change. You see it with the anti-slavery movement, you see it with the suffragette movement, you see it with environmental movements from the 1960s onwards. There are all kinds of ways in which it's grassroots sentiment that ultimately sort of bends the arc of history on this.
Right.
And I do think that we're going to see that over the coming decade, because if we don't, we're witnessing such a transformation of what it means to be America and to be American. You know, that's a huge thing to just stand by and watch.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking with Sasha Abramski about his latest book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. I know that you write from time to time. I read you in The Nation magazine. And recently, John Nichols has written about the woman in Seattle who won the city council position, who is an announced socialist. I contributed to her campaign, and she's called for a $15 minimum wage. I see that as a really promising thing, that the Northwest has a history of being socialistic and very progressive. But I see that as really one indication of a real push for a broad movement, that the people are ripe for that, like pushing for better health care reform.
So I think you're absolutely right. I don't know the details of that particular election, I have to admit. But I do think that locally we're starting to see interesting political movements and interesting ideas emerge. And that goes from the $15 living wage movement, which is attracting a tremendous amount of attention all around the country. But it also goes to local initiatives to try and create more sensible healthcare delivery systems, for example. I know there's been a lot in Oregon about new models of healthcare delivery and new emphasis on preventative healthcare, for example.
Right.
I know that, again, in Oregon, there's been a move to put opticians and mental health clinics and other medical services into low-income schools on the very sensible assumption that if kids aren't getting eye tests and can't see, then they're not going to be performing well in school. In Boston, there's been some really interesting stuff with credit unions buying back foreclosed homes from banks and then selling them at a reduced price back to the original owners so that families don't end up homeless. There's all kinds of interesting microcredit systems that are going into play. Milwaukee has some fascinating microcredit experiments going on. So it seems to me there's some really interesting stuff happening both electorally and also through just really interesting experiments new ways of doing business, let's say. And that's all to the good. That's all to the good. But, you know, coming back to what you were saying about DC and the Beltway, there's no organization or institution with the muscle of the federal government. It's a unique institution. And so even though I think that it's great that these things are happening locally, and even though, as I've just said, I think it's absolutely paramount that grassroots activism pushes from the ground up, ultimately, there also has to be action at a federal level. And there has to be things like the creation of a higher federal minimum wage. There has to be a massive investment in public infrastructure. There has to be a massive national conversation about taxation. Because one of the things that's happened in the last 40 years is an extraordinary amount of money has been lost to the federal treasury by undertaxing wealthy individuals, corporations, wealthy estates, and so on. And there's all kinds of solutions out there. We could create something called a financial transaction tax, a very, very small tax on each financial transaction. But because hedge funds and other investors are doing so many transactions, computer-generated transactions, by sheer volume, you can raise tens and by some measures hundreds of billions of dollars by an almost invisibly small financial transaction tax. And that money could be used to reinvest in schools, in job training, in public works programs during levels of high unemployment. It could be used to build up public transport infrastructure. It could be used to subsidize the purchase of gas in rural areas where there is no public transport and where people are going bankrupt just driving to and from work. There are all kinds of ways in which we could reinvest in the commons.
I think
we're going to have to at some point, but it's going to have to come from the federal government.
I agree. I think that there's definitely intervention called for in the financial industry. You talk about student debt and how the financial industry is exploited. For example, vets coming back to get federal aid to go to for-profit schools. I think for-profit schools have the bulk of students who are in debt. How do you think that the federal government might, have you thought about or do you have any ideas about how the federal government might intervene to interrupt that progress?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One of the biggest proposals, the second part of my book, the first part of my book is really portraying the stories and the experiences of people in poverty. And the second part of the book is much more a meditation on solutions. And one of the big solutions that I advocate in the book is something that I call an educational opportunity fund. And it's a very simple premise, which is that we essentially created social insurance in the 1930s for the back end of people's lives, for their old age. We created Social Security. And the idea was, if you leave everybody to try and navigate old age by themselves, you're going to have millions and millions of impoverished elderly Americans. We do better if we socialize the risk around that. Well, it's the same thing with higher education. If you leave higher education purely to individuals, and obviously there are exceptions with the Pell Grant and various financial aid programs, but more and more individuals are going further and further into debt just to finance a higher education. Well, if you do that, you build up massive levels of debt. There's more student debt in this country now than there is credit card debt. What about if we socialized the risk? What about if we created a line item tax, very small tax? You could start at 0.25%. But a line item income tax, in the same way as we have dedicated taxes for Medicare and for Social Security, what about a line item tax for higher education? What you could do is, with a 0.25% dedicated income tax, that would generate enough money so that every individual at birth would have $5,000 invested into an education account. That would be allowed to grow. By the time they were of college age, it would be nearer $20,000 by most measures, most estimates of how money grows over time. Now, that's not going to pay for higher education, but it's going to do an awful lot to reduce debt. If it works, we could build it up. We could say over a decade, it's going to go up from 0.25% to 1%. Now, that would generate enough money so that every kid at birth could have $20,000 invested into education accounts. And again, by most measures of how that money would perform, that would be $60,000, $70,000, possibly $80,000 by the time they're of college age. Then you're much, much closer to fully funding higher education. So, you know, that's one idea. There are many other ideas, but there's absolutely no reason that we have to accept the status quo on this. It's a very dysfunctional status quo. And that goes for the levels of debt that we accumulate around education, but it also goes for things like the levels of debt we accumulate around healthcare. the current systems we've got in place are very, very expensive and very risky to individuals. And there are other models. There are other models that have been tried out in America. There are other models that are being talked about in America. And there are other models that are operative in other countries that we often like to compare ourselves to.
Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont has just introduced legislation for single payer, for universal, or Medicare for all is a good way to describe it. And I hope that that gets a better response than John Conyers' bill. It's been languishing, really, in the House until I think recently people have become more aware that something really universal and global needs to be done. Do you get that sense? Or
well, I think that, I mean, my sense is that the Affordable Care Act, which obviously got off to a rather rocky start over the last few months, assuming all the computer glitches are ironed out, over the next several months, many millions of Americans who previously couldn't afford health care will be able to afford health care, and it will become an embedded part of our social compact in the same way as Medicare now is and the same way as Social Security now is, that there are some parts of the government-citizen relationship that once created are almost impossible to roll back, that they just become an expected part of society. And I think that's one reason the Republicans fought so very hard to derail the Affordable Care Act right at the beginning, because they realized that if it actually became a success, it would be something that would actually motivate people to get out and vote in order to maintain it. That, in a sense, it would serve as a way of short-circuiting apathy. Because if your own family's affordable health care is on the line in an election, then you bother to vote. But even if the Affordable Care Act goes in its entirety, it's obviously still sort of, in a sense, trying to patch together universal coverage out of an extremely messy system.
Well, and includes,
I think, one of the things you asked about, Medicare for all and single payer, I don't know if that will happen or not, but I do think that one of the things that will happen over the coming years is we will come to expect that the vast majority of Americans will be covered by either private health insurance or health exchanges or various other, all the other parts of the patchwork. And at that point, maybe then it will be possible to have a rational conversation about how best to do that in an affordable way, in a rational way, in an efficient way. And so I think it will become a part of the debate in coming years whether or not we should move towards single payer. But I'm not sure that that will be the ultimate outcome. But I do think it's going to be something that we do debate in coming election cycles.
Well, it's the norm in so many other industrialized countries.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and, even though we do many things better than many other countries, we don't do everything better. And when it comes to poverty, when it comes to things that trigger poverty, like unequal access to healthcare, we do a whole bunch worse than most of the nations that we like to compare ourselves with. And we have a whole bunch to learn. In the same way as other nations have many things to learn from America, so we have things to learn from them. We're part of a global community. And I think that when you realize the scale, the unique scale of not just American poverty, but American inequality in the 21st century, the fact that France doesn't have it, Germany doesn't, Canada doesn't, Australia doesn't, even England, which is the closest to us in terms of sort of economic models, even the United Kingdom doesn't have the levels of inequality that America has. And the levels of social immobility that go with that, the fact that if you're born poor in 21st century America, you're far more likely to stay poor than if you're born poor in countries like Sweden or Holland or Germany or Japan. And I think that speaks to something. It speaks to something that's going wrong in the way the economy and the way the body politic functions.
I agree. What concerns me is that the right-wing Republicans have been able to gerrymander districts to almost guarantee incumbency for a number of Republican representatives. And the presence of things like ALEC, the legislative exchange, and the new thing, this state policy network, which is very similar, and they're exploiting the nonprofit 501c3 mechanism, and they're getting away with this. This is they're being addressed. There's some pushback, but it's really scary to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think ALEC has sort of been uniquely destructive of state government politics in recent years, because if you look at where these sort of coordinated anti-union, anti-public sector efforts come from, if you look at where some of the coordinated efforts to cut state safety nets have come from, all paths lead back to ALEC. And they have done for the last couple decades, that it's this incredibly powerful tool for conservatives who are looking to create a sort of national wave of policy reform at a state level. And, you know, I do think when you look at what happened in Wisconsin, for example, around public sector unions, when you look at some of the right-to-work laws that are being pushed in the old Rust Belt states, you know, when you look at some of the things that are happening around profound issues, around issues of just access to basic services, when you look at some of the rollbacks in the social compact that's going on at the state level, ALEC really is playing a destructive role. And it does so largely from the shadows. It's one of those groups that if you actually talk to people who don't spend all their time in the world of policy, very few people have heard of ALEC. It sort of almost flies below the radar. But it has an extraordinary effect on the way America does politics in the 21st century.
Well, I think one of the ironic things is that when people are struggling to survive, they're working as hard as they can, they don't have the time or energy to listen to really good news coverage. And what they get are these shock jocks from, for example, Fox News, which is Roger Ailes, who was the the campaign director for, or the communications director for, Richard Nixon's campaign. And his whole attitude toward news is just to, you know, to shock and entertain and manipulate and just let, you know, whatever holds people's attention. And to me, that's very scary because people are, they don't know anything but what they have a chance to hear on what they presume is legitimate news. And in fact, we know that there are an awful lot of lies that get conveyed through, for example, Fox News.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the current way the media functions, especially in areas where your choices literally are Fox News or nothing, or Rush Limbaugh or nothing, that there really is a sort of echo chamber effect that you basically, the shriller you are, the louder you are, the more your message reverberates. Doesn't make it a better message, doesn't make it a more accurate message, but noise carries in this media culture. And I think, you know, it's, again, very destructive of a common political language. It's very destructive of a common way of understanding our community. It basically is a language of division. Mm-hmm. It's a language that sells by being divisive. The shriller you are, the more you will sell. You know, I do think that the conservative side of that is particularly destructive, but it isn't only a conservative issue. There are plenty of very shrill commentators on the left as well. And I think one of the problems in the modern moment is that we've lost the ability to think outside of our bubble, and that we're so saturated by media that we basically gravitate to whoever's going to say something we already agree with. Now, when I'm writing, I love to challenge my audience. If I'm writing for The Nation, for example, I love to say something counterintuitive that's going to actually make my readers think, maybe get outside their comfort zone a little bit. But I think increasingly that readers are looking to be reaffirmed rather than to be challenged. And that's something that, you know, anybody who cares about journalism has got to think really, really carefully about how to deal with that. What are the implications of living in the echo chamber?
I wanted to ask you about, you had a very terrifying piece in your book, The American Way of Poverty, mentioning the English political philosopher Stephen Lucas and writing about power. Could you talk about that?
It's the idea that there are different ways of manipulating a society or an individual, that power is expressed at the most basic level through brute force. You can compel somebody to do something essentially by saying, if you don't do it, we're going to physically punish you. And then there's this sort of progressive set of levels of subtlety. You can basically get people to do things by manipulating the way they understand the context. You can get someone to do something by shifting the kind of information they have available to them. And at the most sophisticated level, you basically create a framework that's so all-pervasive that it becomes invisible. It just becomes the backdrop. And everything takes place against that backdrop. And you no longer realize you're being manipulated. You no longer realize that the way you understand events or the way you respond to authority, in a sense, is being predetermined. You think you're absolutely free to make decisions, because you're not really understanding where those decisions are coming from.
It's
a fascinating way of understanding the world, that the more sophisticated a machinery of propaganda becomes, the harder it is to see that machinery at work.
Which brings us back to your EOF, the Educational Opportunity Fund, and trying to guarantee access to higher education and a decent open education. Otherwise, I don't see much way to push back against that kind of manipulation, because that takes money, and so the people with money, like the Koch brothers and others, are able to get away with this kind of manipulation.
Well, I think one of the things we've seen in the last few years with the Koch brothers and others is that the Citizens United ruling in particular essentially liberated wealthy individuals to basically spend vast amounts of money, and wealthy corporations as well, to spend vast amounts of money essentially trying to buy access to the political process. And, you know, when you're a billionaire and you're throwing around tens of millions of dollars, you're not doing it out of the goodness of your heart. You're doing it as an investment. You basically think it's a cheap way to get your needs taken care of. So the most obvious example is we've seen a tremendous amount of money being thrown into the system by business groups that stand to gain from particular tax cuts. Or we've seen tremendous amounts of money being thrown in by pharmaceutical companies looking to impact the way that medical bills are charged. So you see these very, very powerful interest groups using their money very effectively to essentially try and shift the political discourse and to push the candidacies of pliant candidates, of candidates who will essentially support a set of policies which are being determined in boardrooms rather than in open policy debate.
And the thing is,
and that's been done before in this country. The robber barons at the tail end of the 19th century essentially bought the political process, and it created ultimately a huge backlash in the progressive era with Teddy Roosevelt and the great regulations that came about during the progressive era. That was largely as a backlash to the role of the robber barons of California. You know, there's this huge progressive outpouring grew up in California in response to the essentially political depredations of the oil industry and the railway industry.
And a big factor in that, speaking of California, Upton Sinclair and other writers like him, just informing the country of the reality of labor conditions and the food quality and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, Upton Sinclair, I'm glad you mentioned him, because, you know, in a sense, any conversation that includes Michael Harrington really should include Upton Sinclair as well. Sinclair is a figure who towers over American journalism in a way for about 30 years. Before World War I, Sinclair wrote a book called The Jungle, right. And it was this wonderful expose, very disturbing expose, of what daily life was like inside the meatpacking factories in Chicago. And it created a sensation. And one of the consequences of The Jungle was the introduction of the FDA, of food and drug regulations, of basic safety regulations around the kinds of food we ate and the conditions in which the food was made, and also workplace regulations. But the other thing that makes Sinclair such a fascinating character is that in the Great Depression, he runs a political campaign in California. He runs for governor, and he runs on a campaign called EPIC, End Poverty in California. And Sinclair didn't win, but he got a tremendous amount of support, and he helped shift and frame the policy debate around poverty. He helped make it a central dominating issue, an issue that no serious politician in that period could afford to ignore. And today we have people talking about the struggling middle class. Well, the struggling middle class is one part. It's an important part, but it's only one part of a much larger story. Because the story of poverty today isn't just about the struggling middle class, but it's about people who never, ever were a part of the middle class to begin with. It's about people who earn $5,000-$7,000 a year as fast food workers. It's about farm laborers who work for 12, 13 hours a day and live in shanties. It's about kids who are going to school hungry and coming home and still ending up hungry. And those people, those individuals, those men, women, and kids, their stories aren't being told. And I love the notion of someone like Upton Sinclair focusing this lens on their lives and saying, look, this is unacceptable, and launching a campaign, an End Poverty in California campaign. There's something very noble about Sinclair there.
And, well, also Jacob Riis, who wrote a little bit earlier, How the Other Half Lives. Writers like that and yourself are, you know, this is what's needed. And personally, I really enjoyed your book, The American Way of Poverty. I'm going to conclude with that, except to ask you what you're currently working on.
I'm actually finishing up a family memoir about my grandparents' lives and about their house in London, and that's going to come out in England in about 6-7 months. And beyond that, I'm doing an awful lot of writing on themes related to the American way of poverty.
Right. Good. Good. Looking forward to it. Do you have any articles we can look for specifically?
Well, when the new year comes, I'll be doing a few articles for The Nation around the war on poverty, the anniversary of the launching of the war on poverty.
Well, we'll look forward to that. This has been Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon, talking with Sasha Abramsky about his latest book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Sasha, thank you very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kboo.fm/MLKBreakfast2014.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Why KBOO? Because on the website they said unpopular, controversial, and something else. And I was like, I'm unpopular and controversial at times.
It's also a place for people to meet up and to collaborate on ideas, and that's a monumental thing, really.
It's the only place for me to go to play my kind of music on the radio. I just love it. I'm really grateful for it.
Just having the opportunity for anyone to do radio is really cool.
That's what KBOO is about, and I couldn't be able to do it anywhere else. For me, it's a life's work, and they just allow me to push it.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with a lawyer for the family of Andy Lopez about a new expanded federal civil rights complaint against a Sonoma County deputy sheriff for killing the Latino teen, and the electronic intifada reports on the release of a Palestinian hunger striker after 17 months in prison. At 11 o'clock, the Dirtbag will be here with your host, Glenn Andreessen. He welcomes back Columbia County OSU Extension Service Agricultural Agent Chip Bubel to talk about veggies and what to do about cold, damaged plants. Also, Chip will talk about the importance of having the right amount of nitrogen in the soil and when. And thank you again, KBOO members, for your great support, and we hope you keep it coming. And if you're not a member, you can go to kbu.fm and click on Donate Today. Coming right up at the top of the hour, 10 o'clock, hear Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, January 8th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines before we speak with our guest today. We're very, very fortunate to have Jonathan Latham joining us to discover that, surprise, surprise, regulators have found a hidden viral gene in commercial GMO crops. No wonder our European and Asian trading partners are getting a little skittish. And it's not just the gooey ducks this time. So first, before we speak with Jonathan, I've got a few headlines for you from around the region. Healthcare, now that it's made quasi-available, it seems people are availing themselves of health care. Experts are expertly puzzling their way through the issue. And Columbia Riverkeeper is once again stepping up to the plate in defense of sensitive habitat. County commissioners voted unanimously in November to allow the rezoning of 137 acres of land adjacent to Port Westwood. It's a major energy park north of Klutskanai. And what they're planning is industrial use. Columbia River Keeper, Dan Sears, we'll try to have Dan on tomorrow, have other ideas for the land. And let's not forget, a great many other organisms besides human life live there. And Portland public school leaders have offered large concessions on two of the biggest sticking points in negotiations with the teachers' union in an attempt to avert what would be the first strike in district history. Thus spake the Oregonian. And I hope you're able to discern the quotes there around those past words. They forget entirely the concessions that teachers make simply coming on a daily basis, simply by showing up for what is arguably one of the most difficult jobs and the lowest paying jobs available. Chief Executive of Terminal Operator ICTSI Oregon says no sustained improvement since the agreement with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Well, of course, it's possible that ICTSI would understate productivity improvements to strengthen its hand in contract negotiations with Hanjin and other ocean carriers. Also, it's possible that since they brought in scabs, the work wouldn't be up to the standards of the usual union workers. And days before the Castleton oil train explosion, something that made the news, here's something that didn't make the news. President Obama signed a bill hastening fracking permits on North Dakota public lands. Yeah, the filters are fascinating. But what's more fascinating than the filters are the connections between stories. And ExxonMobil subsidiary XTO Energy will have to face criminal charges for allegedly dumping tens of thousands of gallons of hydraulic fracturing waste, that's of course fracking waste, at Marcellus Shale drilling site back in 2010. That's the huge deposit that stretches